Hatcher Pass, it's narrow, there's oftentimes weather, but we also oftentimes have a lot of people recreating in the area. And, you know, using a howitzer just would not be conducive.
Instead of a cannon to mitigate an avalanche, DOT opts for a safer solution. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a February oil spill north of Kodiak still doesn't have a cleanup completion date.
Can be a delicate, tricky thing on removing the oil without destroying everything else that's there in the process.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating more than 40 years of Alaska operations.
Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is asking for public input on the controversial Pebble Mine proposal. In April, the federal agency will be holding meetings in Bristol Bay, Anchorage, and Homer to hear the public's views and concerns about the project. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced its estimated timeline for preparing an environmental impact statement on the Pebble Mine project. The Pebble Limited Partnership submitted its federal permit application in December for an open-pit copper, gold, and molybdenum mine in Bristol Bay, near Iliamna Lake and Lake Clark. The Corps of Engineers is the lead agency responsible for reviewing the permit application, and the environmental impact statement is a key piece of that review process. The EIS findings of potential benefits and environmental impacts of the Pebble project ultimately will weigh heavily in the final decision of whether or not to issue a permit for the proposed mine. The Corps of Engineers will hold a 30-day scoping period starting April 1st. The scoping period is an opportunity for the public to weigh in on the mine. Shane McCoy is the program manager for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Regulatory Program.
We will be holding public scoping meetings in 7 venues currently, with the intent of soliciting comments from the public.
McCoy stressed that comments that are specific in their views or concerns will be especially helpful as the Corps of Engineers incorporates public input into the EIS.
If individuals could identify resources of concern or potential alternatives other than what the applicant is proposing, that will help inform us as to what direction and the level of analysis on some of these resources that we will be considering.
Some groups opposed to Pebble Mine have expressed concern that a one-month scoping period will not provide adequate opportunity for testimony. Awana Hurley is the executive director of the United Tribes of Bristol Bay.
The scoping piece of permitting is the public's opportunity to help the Army Corps figure out what areas they should be considering and what impacts this type of project could have on our people. We're almost at the end of March right now. We have less than a month to prepare for these hearings that are going to be happening in the region. More than 30 days is what the people of Bristol Bay need, and Alaskans.
The Corps of Engineers estimates that it will finalize the environmental impact statement by the end of 2019. It anticipates making a decision about whether or not to issue a permit to the Pebble Mine project shortly afterward in early 2020. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Sheldon Fisher, Governor Bill Walker's choice to be the next commissioner of the Alaska Department of Revenue, had a confirmation hearing in the Senate Finance Committee today. He was appointed in September to replace Randall Hoffbeck, who resigned to return to religious ministry. Fisher says he supports diversifying the sources of revenue for the state, but he didn't champion any individual tax during the hearing. Fisher is the former Department of Administration commissioner and previously worked as an executive at McKinley Capital Management and Alaska Communications. After the hearing, Fisher said the biggest source of new revenue should be a draw on Alaska Permanent Fund earnings.
My ambition is to try to bring some degree of stability to Alaska so that we can begin to see investment return to our state and put people back to work.
Fisher says if the legislature approves a permanent fund draw plan, then it can return in the future to close the rest of the gap between state spending and revenue. That could occur through either new taxes or spending cuts. Fisher says a plan to pay oil and gas tax credits by selling state bonds also would help investment in the state. Under the plan, oil companies would have the option to take lower rates for the credits in return for receiving the cash sooner than they would under current state law.
It's a win for our budget because we can reduce the amount of the obligation during the upcoming period. It's a win for the producers because they can kind of clean up their balance sheet and get back to work. And it's a win for Alaskans because it will be an infusion in our economy at a time when we need it.
The legislature hasn't announced when it will vote on all of Walker's appointees. The road into Hatcher Pass in the Talkeetna Mountains north of Palmer is expected to open this evening after avalanches blocked it Monday morning. About 10 people were stranded in the pass when two separate snowslides came down from Marmot Mountain, piling debris across the roadway. Most of those stuck in the pass were reportedly staying at the well-provisioned Hatcher Pass Lodge. Department of Transportation spokesperson Shannon McCarthy says danger from future avalanches prevented crews from clearing the debris until avalanche mitigation work could be done.
They had just had 12 to 15 inches of new snow, which is that kind of critical time within that 24 to 48 hours after a new snow that we'll see a lot of slides let loose.
The mitigation generally involves using explosives to intentionally trigger avalanches before removing the debris. And to do that, DOT will often shoot a howitzer cannon into an avalanche-prone mountainside. But the team in Hatcher Pass on Tuesday instead used what's called a daisy bell system. That's a bell-shaped piece of equipment that dangles on a line beneath a helicopter and can deliver a concussive blast to trigger a slide. McCarthy says the daisy bell is much more precise than a cannon.
In Hatcher Pass, it's narrow. There's oftentimes weather. But we also oftentimes have a lot of people recreating in the area. And, you know, using a howitzer just would not be conducive.
With the mitigation work done Tuesday, McCarthy says it was safe enough today to send plows, a snowblower, and a grader into the pass to clear away the snow. The work was expected to be completed by about 5 p.m. Also today, DOT is dealing with a different type of mayhem on South Central roadways. The southbound lanes of the Glen Highway were shut down near Eagle River this afternoon after an 18-wheeler carrying a tall load crashed into a bridge over the highway. McCarthy says engineers were inspecting the bridge before motorists could drive either over it or under it. Drivers were able to bypass the area by detouring through Eagle River. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, citing budget cuts, Big Brothers Big Sisters of Alaska leaves some rural communities.
It's a mistake to close this program down because in the rural areas, the kids don't have other programs that can fill in.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
In a violent attempted home invasion last weekend, an Alakanuk man allegedly tried to kill his daughter and infant granddaughter with a semi-automatic rifle. He was stopped in the Arctic entryway by his daughter's boyfriend, who armed himself, tackled the shooter, and held him down until state troopers arrived. KYUK's Teresa Katsarilis has more.
According to State Trooper William Connor's report, the incident began early Saturday morning. Leroy Patrick, age 42, loaded his semi-automatic rifle with a 20-round magazine and then walked to his daughter Sherry Andrews' house. She was fast asleep with her boyfriend, Greg Konst, and her 18-month-old daughter. Andrew and Konst told troopers that Patrick first fired a round into their home from outside. Then he walked up the steps and forced his way into their Arctic entryway. He fired another round into the main door frame. "Open the door," Konst remembers Patrick saying repeatedly, "or I will shoot again." The family hit the floor, and Const grabbed his 12-gauge shotgun. He says Patrick fired two more rounds into the house. Bullet fragments hit the side of Const's face, and he said he could feel it burning. Lying on the ground, Const managed to load a single round and fired it through the front door. It hit Patrick below the knee, and that was when Const decided to rush him. He says he disarmed Patrick and pinned him to the floor until the troopers came to take him away. Trooper Connors reports finding bullet damage inside the home, and there were still 14 rounds of live ammunition in Patrick's rifle. Connors also writes that alcohol was a factor in this incident. Patrick was arraigned on 4 counts of assault, in addition to burglary and other charges. He's been convicted of assault 4 times in the past 5 years. His bail is set at $150,000, with his next court appearance set for next week. In Bethel, I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
Alaska State Troopers are investigating the death of 70-year-old Marvin Yagi in Perryville. Witnesses told troopers they saw Yagi's grandson, 21-year-old Brandon Yagi, attack Marvin Yagi twice on early Sunday morning. The witnesses allege that Brandon Yagi threatened them when they tried to intervene, so they fled for their own safety. Later Sunday morning, witnesses said they found Marvin Yagi dead and made a report to AST. Troopers were unable to fly to Perryville until Monday due to poor weather conditions. Upon arriving in the village, they arrested Brandon Yagi on charges of murder, assault, and evidence tampering. Brandon Yagi was taken to the King Salmon Jail. Marvin Yagi's body will undergo autopsy in Anchorage. According to AST, alcohol was a factor in the incident. Troopers will continue to investigate and expect to file additional charges related to the case. A weeks-old spill about 50 miles north of Kodiak will likely take weeks more to clean up. At the end of February, 3,000 gallons of oil spilled in the Shuyak Strait. Since then, a response has been underway to contain the spill, clean it up, and prevent future spills. But as KMXT's Mitch Borden reports, cleanup crews can't say when their work will be complete.
When asked how long it's going to take to clean up the oil spill in the Shuyak Strait, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation's on-scene coordinator, Jeff Morrell, says longer than weeks, but less than years.
We can't mark a date on a calendar that says we're going to be done by here.
The oil spill happened when a building on Shuyak Island collapsed and a fuel bladder in it, filled with about 3,000 gallons of Bunker C oil, released its contents into the Shuyak Strait. The oil's been contained, but cleanup efforts have been impeded because the wreckage of the building is blocking the initial spill site. A crane has been ordered to the area to help remove the structure's remains. Morrell says it may seem like the cleanup is taking a long time, but he says the operation is complicated.
It can be a delicate, tricky thing on removing the oil without destroying everything else that's there in the process, which really serves no purpose at all.
The building that collapsed was a part of a bigger compound made up of structures of all shapes and sizes, some of which date back to before World War II. The site's been used for all sorts of things like a steamship fuel depot, a fish processing plant, and a float plane terminal. Morrell says the site doesn't seem to be used for much at the moment, and currently there's an investigation into who all owns the property. Morrell says the spilled oil isn't the only problem facing the area. There's another estimated 3,000 gallons of fuel, oil, and other lubricants stored in buildings near the water that could collapse in the future. Cleanup personnel are carefully making their way through the old structures, looking for these petroleum products.
So that they don't become either an additional pollutant or, you know, a pollutant down the road where, you know, we'd just be out to the same site in the future, cleaning up something that we'd left behind this time.
So far, there hasn't been any signs the oil spill has affected local wildlife. Morrell says his team is keeping an eye out for oiled animals, especially those that call the strait their home.
Aquatic mammals, specifically sea otters, sea lions, and river otters. And then very shortly, we're going to start the annual bird migration. So there will be an increasing presence of waterfowl in the area, which we're concerned about.
Recently, an in-depth environmental and structural analysis was done at the spill site. According to a recent Coast Guard press release, the study will help personnel safely conduct further cleanup efforts. Around 240 bags of oily waste has been removed from the Shuyuk Strait so far. In Kodiak, I'm Mitch Borden.
About 20% of Homer residents have access to natural gas to heat their homes. For those who don't, heating oil is an expensive alternative. That forces some residents to consider less conventional options like coal. More Homer residents are switching to burning coal they collect themselves off the beach. Aaron Bolton has the story for the Cost of Coal series from Alaska's Energy Desk.
Karen Hamm is walking along the tide line at a popular beach on the Homer Spit, 5-gallon bucket in hand. She reaches down to collect chunks of coal. Some are pebble-sized and others are large as a loaf of bread. Hamm says it's not an ideal day to scavenge.
It's always better after a storm, first of all. Secondly, the wind has to be coming from the west, because if it's coming from the east, it's going to blow it out instead of in.
Hamm would know. She's been scavenging for coal with her husband for 7 years. The coal that washes up on Homer beaches comes from veins in the bluffs that line Cook Inlet and overlook town. Boulder-sized sections of coal break off the cliffs, are turned up in the ocean, and wash onto area beaches in smaller pieces. And Hamm needs about 9,000 pounds of coal to heat her home every winter. She and her husband typically drive onto the beach and fill the bed of their truck about 9 times every year.
You go to the beach, you get cold, and then you go home and you stand next to the coal fire.
Back at her home, Hamm pulls brick-sized pieces of coal from a trailer and brings them inside. But before she burns anything, she needs to empty out the ash box.
There's a lot more ash with coal than there is with wood. Not only that, but it gets in the air. See that? It's messy.
That's the dusting regimen?
Yeah. Yes, yes. But it's cheap. You can afford to hire a maid.
Those savings are what drove Hamm and her husband George to ditch their wood stove and install a coal stove. Hamm, who is 80 years old, used to self-gather wood and says it would take about 5 cords to heat his 2,500 square foot home each year. He also supplements with heating oil when they're not home.
You can just figure that if you burn 100 gallons of oil, you're going to burn a cord of wood, or you're going to burn a ton of coal. Those are not accurate figures, but it gives you a round figure to work with.
No one knows exactly how many people burn coal in Homer, but it seems to be getting more popular, likely because it's free. After a big winter storm, you can see a number of people on the beach collecting coal.
Has there been more competition on the beach lately then?
Yes. I think it has a lot to do with our economy right now.
For Laura Upp, that was certainly the case. She switched to a coal and wood-burning stove about 5 years ago after wood became too expensive.
Cords of wood cut and split for you are almost near $200 anymore delivered, so that's a lot of money. And I would typically, if I was only burning wood, I would go through a cord of wood probably in a month.
Upp still uses some wood and supplements with oil. Both Hamm and Upp acknowledge that burning coal isn't ideal. They worry about the air quality, but they say the savings and convenience drives them and others to the beaches.
I think people are just trying to find cheaper alternatives. I know it's not the best thing for the environment, but right now, it's just what I have to do.
Upp says she would consider other options, such as natural gas if it was available, but for the foreseeable future, she will continue beachcombing for coal. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Aaron Bolton, reporting in Homer.
The Cost of Coal is a series from Alaska's Energy Desk about how Alaskans around the state heat their homes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committed to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Owners of local marijuana businesses told the Fairbanks City Council on Monday that the free market should decide how many retail pot shops the city should allow. The owners and other advocates told council members a proposed ordinance that would limit the number of shops and impose other regulations on the industry could stifle the economic benefits it's generating. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The marijuana business owners and their allies did everything but quote Adam Smith in explaining why they oppose the restrictions in the proposed ordinance.
It's a free market. It's capitalism. It's the American dream.
Mason Evans says he and his fellow cannabis capitalists, who turned out for Monday's two-hour work session, all invested heavily in their businesses because they saw opportunity. He says the limit of 12 retail shops in the city that the ordinance would impose would be unfair to a handful of those whose applications are still pending and to others who want to get into the business.
You guys don't need to pick winners or losers. Limiting licenses will limit the growth of Fairbanks. You're saying, all right, this number of people is all that's going to be here. You know, what happens if Fairbanks booms?
Councilman Jonathan Bagwell, who opposes the marijuana industry and supports the ordinance, says he doesn't understand why the business owners don't like the idea.
From a business standpoint, I don't even know that that makes sense to me. If I had a business, I wouldn't want there to be 140 businesses like mine in the same city. If I'm in a business, it's to make money.
But Dan Peters says that's not how he and his fellow retailers see it.
My business will benefit either way. I am good enough at my business to hold my own against any other business that comes along, so I'm not worried about other licenses and license caps.
Vivian Stivers, a former council member who also opposes the industry, reminded the business owners that the ordinance would set the number of retail shops according to population. That would be about one shop per 3,000 people, just as alcohol licenses are allocated, she said, encouraging the council to hold to that.
It's been said since day one. The numbers that you have on your retail and other stores, like you saw, are set in the alcohol regulations, and I believe you're on the right track. Those should be followed.
Councilman Jerry Cleworth followed up on that point a few minutes later when pressing Evans on why he and the others now don't want to adhere to that.
So what's happened here?
What's happened here is everybody, like I said, is sailing uncharted waters.
Evans and others say regulating marijuana like alcohol was just a starting point. They said they're obviously different substances, so city officials should resist calls to place additional restrictions on the marijuana industry that may turn out to be unnecessary. The point was underlined in an exchange between Councilman David Prues and Ray Brazier, a local real estate agent who's worked with the businesses and who says a shortage of qualifying commercial real estate in Fairbanks may settle the issue of how many retail shops the city can support.
It's certainly getting more and more difficult to find areas that you meet all the restrictions, both the state as well as the borough ordinance setbacks. Whether we've reached full saturation, I do think we're probably approaching that.
Mayor Jim Matherly says he intends to set up additional meetings, including one with marijuana industry opponents, before the council revisits the ordinance for final amendments and possible approval in the May 7th meeting. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Alaska will no longer make new matches between young people and volunteers in four Alaska communities, Haines, Homer, Hoona, and Sitka. The organization, which matches volunteers and youth for one-on-one mentoring, says it's a matter of reduced federal and state grant funding. Dasha Eaton reports from KHNS in Haines.
Rosalie Lowen opens a filing cabinet at the Big Brothers Big Sisters office in downtown Haines, filled with file folders for hundreds of mentors and youths they've served.
Well, it's packed in there so tight that I can't actually put any more files in there.
As she's getting ready to close the office, she says she's been reflecting on all the lives that have been touched by the program over its 15 years in Haines.
And I remember that it's not just the names that are in that filing cabinet, but their siblings and their parents and all of the other kids in their classroom. And just it's just a big piece of the way the fabric holds together for this community.
Lowen is the community director for Big Brothers Big Sisters of Haines, where for the past 2 years, she's been responsible for all aspects of the program. The nonprofit specializes in helping kids connect with adult mentors. Lowen says the program serves about 10% of youth in the Haines school. The change was announced on Friday and goes into effect May 31st. Big Brothers Big Sisters will close their offices in the four communities and consolidate them to Anchorage and Juneau, where a dedicated staff specialist will focus on serving existing matches. Lowen says the closure is unfortunate.
It's a little frustrating to see the program close now because research is showing us more and more that kids who experience developmental trauma, one of the most important things that you can do that will create a more positive outcome in their lives is to match them with an adult mentor with a stable, healthy, positive relationship.
In 2017, Big Brothers Big Sisters of Alaska served more than 580 youths across the state. The organization has an annual budget of $1.6 million and 20 employees. Heather Harris, CEO for Big Brothers Big Sisters of Alaska, says the organization gets about half of its funding from federal and state grant monies, which are disappearing.
We're in a difficult financial place, and we have to make incredibly difficult decisions.
Big Brothers Big Sisters has been working in Alaska since 1972. Harris says she's hopeful the organization will eventually be able to reopen their offices in the communities. Although she's heartbroken about the Haines office closing, Lowen is also realistic, saying the days of big grants and free-flowing funds to solve the state's social problems are over.
Things will have to be homegrown and come up from the bottom. But I feel not entirely pessimistic about that because in my mind, that's what Alaskans are really good at, is pulling themselves up by the bootstraps and being independent and making things work.
Staff in the four communities have been given the opportunity to continue on a part-time basis. Lowen will not be one of them. Lowen says she has one more young person on the waiting list for a mentor match, and she plans on making that connection before she closes the Big Brothers Big Sisters office door in Haines one last time. In Haines, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Avery Lill in Dillingham, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Casey Grove in Anchorage, Teresa Katsarilis in Bethel, Mitch Borden in Kodiak, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Daisha Eaton in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.